Sunday, June the 27th, and it's time to bring a reading of the Sioux City Journal this afternoon. It's about 4 o'clock broadcast time for folks that are listening, and it's a Sunday morning here. I'm Alan McGaffin. My wife is sitting next to me.
Good morning. I'm Terry McGaffin. We're ready to bring you the Sioux City Journal, and we'll start with the mini editorial this morning.
It's from the Sioux City Journal staff, and they just have a thanks to all the volunteers that are helping with Saturday in the Park. It's a two-day event this week instead of the single day as we've seen for the last 30 years. So it's taken more hands and more effort, and it should be coming together pretty well up there.
Yes. So let's jump ahead to the weather, Alan, if you can move ahead to that page.
We've got a pretty moderate forecast for the week ahead. We've got a chance of thunderstorms are still around this afternoon, a high of 80 degrees today. Tonight, a low of 60 degrees and thunderstorms forecast to hit a few places. Monday, a high of 80 degrees, sunny skies, partly cloudy. Tuesday, 81. Wednesday, 84. And Thursday, 83 for a high temperature. Not a whole lot of moisture coming this week. Looks like from the rain gauges, about to half to three quarters of an inch, averaging around the Sioux City area.
Yes, and we're very thankful for the rain. It looks like a beautiful week ahead as we approach the holiday weekend. All right, so we'll return to page one of the Sioux City Journal and the lead story this morning. Alan, do you care to read it?
I'll start with an eviction story. This is from Aaron Murphy, who writes for the newspapers across Iowa. Nearly 41,000 Iowans are fearing eviction or foreclosure once the federal moratorium is lifted, according to federal census data. The situation has community leaders on edge over the possible explosion of evictions, and they're looking for solutions. We've been talking to Iowa Legal Aid, talking to the Shelter House. There's concern, says Tracy Heitschuh, Neighborhood Development Services Director for the City of Iowa City. Heitschuh says the concern is high that Iowa Legal Aid and the area social service providers plan July 12th at the Johnson County Courthouse to start a help desk for tenants and landlords involved in the eviction process. The idea is to work with the parties to see what can be done to prevent evictions. If you work with us, if you try to work with the tenant, we'll try to get back your rent paid if you don't evict, Heitschuh says. Around 84,000 Iowa adults say they live in a house that is not current on rent or mortgage payments, according to federal census results. Of those households, about half, or 41,000, say it is somewhat or very likely they will be evicted in the next couple months. This is the sixth highest rate in the country. The data is taken from the U.S. Census Bureau's House Pulse Survey, which is produced every 2 weeks and designed to show snapshots of how American households are being impacted by the pandemic. Neither Sioux City nor local housing nonprofits have kept a number of the people in Sioux City who use the eviction moratorium or how many people are facing eviction. So there is little official sense of how large or how small the problem may be in Northwest Iowa's largest community. An organizer said roughly a dozen people have approached her organization seeking help. She says, we've already had a few that haven't paid or haven't been able to pay or are behind, coming with their three-day notice to quit, Peckinpah says. She says landlords are already starting the process of documenting their efforts so that when the eviction moratorium ends, they can move right in with the eviction process. Amy Tooley, Housing Services Division Manager for Sioux City Housing Authority, said some avenues remain open for renters who could face eviction. The Housing Authority has housing choice vouchers to help renters, although the wait list is approximately 60 to 90 days and they can't help people who are behind on rent. Housing Authority also received 39 emergency housing vouchers from the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, which are intended to prevent homelessness in a targeted group of people, mostly individuals who are at high risk of homelessness or those who are trying to flee abuse, sex violence, human trafficking, or stalking. These vouchers authorized under the American Rescue Plan will be issued beginning the 1st of July, and they'll remain in effect at least until September of 2023. While Iowa has a high share of households behind on rent or mortgage payments and worried about eviction, the state has the lowest rate in the country. 11% of adults who are behind on rent or mortgage payments and are worried about where they're about making their next payment. In other words, Iowa has the lowest share in the country of adults behind or worried about mortgage and rent payments. But among those who are behind, Iowa has one of the worst rates for those who fear eviction or foreclosure. A federal moratorium on eviction for renters behind on payments was scheduled to expire at the end of this month, but the CDC and Prevention this week extended the moratorium, and now it won't expire until the 31st of July. The moratorium has been in place since September. Iowa also had a state moratorium, but the governor lifted that in May of 2020, leaving the federal moratorium as the only protection that renters have. Alex Cornea, general counsel at Iowa Legal Aid, said he's concerned that evictions will spike in Iowa once the CDC moratorium ends, particularly because the state quit participating in enhanced unemployment benefits this month, depriving recipients of $300 a week in federal aid. We see enough of that out there to be extremely worried about what the future will hold, Mr. Cornea says. Local leaders say the eviction moratorium's been helpful. In Scott County, the number of writs of possession, essentially a legal eviction notice, issued during a 15-month period from March 2020 through June of this year, was roughly half of what it was in the 15 months prior to that time period. In Linn County, Community Outreach and Assistance Director Ashley Baileyus said the moratoriums helped keep people housed during the shortage. We always have known we needed more housing and affordable housing, but man, we have been thankful for the moratorium. It's hard for local programs who are housing folks to get people housed because there just aren't any vacancies. Baileyus said her hope is that the county will be ready with programs to help with the Emergency Rental Assistance Program before the moratorium expires, whenever that may be, to stall evictions so it isn't a mass exodus. The Linn County Courthouse can only do so many evictions per day, so it will help stifle the flow a little bit, she says. However, that doesn't change the fact that right now we're looking at August. It's going to be a difficult month. I think there'll be a lot of people in and out of units, so we're trying to set things up so we don't see a substantial increase in our homeless population. The county aims to get millions of dollars from assistance programs in the hands of renters and landlords. Like homeowners, landlords were affected by the derecho in eastern Iowa, and they had to pay a lot of money for repairs and may have not been getting income during that time either. Some are in a precarious situation, especially those smaller landowners who are critical partners in this city as well. Cedar Rapids Community Development Director Jenny Pratt said the city spent about $1 million helping more than 650 households through the Eviction Prevention Program, which provides income households grappling with impacts of the pandemic, as well as rent and utility payment assistance. The city launched that program in April. The city has more than a year to spend the remaining money, about $500,000 currently allocated to Cedar Rapids. The city also leverages efforts from the county, from Linn County, the Iowa Finance Authority, and local nonprofits to avoid duplicating resources and provide aid where it is most needed. At the end of the CDC's moratorium on eviction, Pratt says the city's urged people to seek eviction prevention assistance now and not wait until the moratorium expires. We'd love to get people in as soon as possible so there's not this big rush and push at the end. So at this point, we have everything in place and we're ready to go. Some organizations help Iowans in need of housing or shelter, and they're worried about the influx of new people in need once the moratorium is lifted. The Salvation Army of Cedar Falls and Waterloo recently noted it was forced to combine its women's and men's shelter into one facility, citing a critical staffing shortage. They're looking at 2 full-time employees and at least 4 part-timers to be able to adequately staff 2 shelters again for 24 hours a day. Until the positions are filled and trained, they hope the end of the summer. Major Shannon Tees said the organization is leaning on its partner like Operation Threshold and Jesse Cosby Center for help for families before they get to the point of needing shelter. We're thankful it's been extended another month to help them through these difficult times, Tees says. Not all local officials agree that eviction moratorium has been helpful. Justin Stoats, executive director of North Iowa Regional Housing Authority, said the program may be kicking a problem down the road rather than addressing it. I feel the moratorium is not really beneficial unless you provide some type of support to help tenants get away, to get out of a situation when they're facing eviction because of an inability to pay rent, Stoats said. Just keeping landlords from being able to evict tenants without helping those tenants pay the rent isn't a workable situation long term. It makes the landlords suffer, and that could be why landlords don't want to participate with low-end clients. Karen Mackey, exec director of the Sioux City Human Rights Commission, also notes the issue that landlords face as a result of the eviction moratorium. Although some resources have been made available to the landlords and as in addition to the renters, Mackey says this has been a problem for not just tenants, but not just homeowners, but landlords. They're still trying to make payments. Often they don't own the property free and clear, and maybe now their tenants don't pay the rent because they've been impacted by COVID, Mackey says. So it's been a problem for a lot of different folks. Those reporters that contributed to this were from the Sioux City Journal, Mason Doctor at the Journal, Jared McNett of the Mason City Globe-Gazette, Lee Hermiston and Gage Miskeman, and Marissa Payne of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Tom Lowy of the Quad City Times, Arnie Rivers of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, and Joshua Funk of the Associated Press.
All right, the other lead story on page 1 of the Sioux City Journal this morning is called Lessons Learned. Flood makes residents better prepared for the future. And it's from Nick Heitrich of the Sioux City Journal, and he writes, walking on a levee next to the Missouri River on the south edge of Dakota Dunes, Jeff Dooley can still picture the temporary levees hastily constructed 10 years ago to keep the swollen river out of the planned community. The 2,000-foot levee he walks on now wasn't a permanent fixture back in 2011, but after the historic flooding up and down the Missouri River Valley that threatened the community for weeks, leaders here decided they weren't going to be caught in the same precarious situation again. In 2012, the levee was added along the Dakota Dunes Country Club, and it's protected Dakota Dunes from high river levels in 2018 and 19. That improvement was very much worth it, said Dooley, manager of the Dakota Dunes Community Improvement District. We're in a lot better position than we were in 2011. It's been 10 years since the Missouri River at Sioux City rose past its 30-foot flood stage and reached 35.25 feet, or 35 and a quarter feet, the peak of the 2011 flood. Caused when heavy rainfall upstream and melting mountain snow filled the river and its reservoirs and forced the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to release water through Gavin's Point Dam near Yankton, South Dakota, at a rate of 160,000 cubic feet per second. The record-breaking runoff and reservoir releases pushed the Missouri out of its banks, leaving large swaths of land underwater for months and causing hundreds of millions of dollars in damage. Those weeks of holding back the Missouri taught public officials and private residents lessons that were not quickly forgotten. Now, those who keep a close eye on the river say Siouxland is better prepared to withstand and respond to the next big flood. There's been a lot of progress, said Gary Brown, who at the time was the Woodbury County Emergency Management Director, and will soon retire as director of the county's emergency services. We didn't have a manual to follow. Now, if it happens again, we at least have a roadmap to follow. We have a record of what we did last time. When waters began rising to crisis levels around Memorial Day in 2011, emergency directors rushed to respond. The river hadn't seen a flood of this magnitude since 1952, before the series of six reservoirs designed to control flooding was completed. There wasn't much experience to draw upon, and flood predictions changed by the hour. That was probably the hardest part, the nonstop changing of information and changing how we plan to respond, what resources we would need, Brown said. Temporary levees were constructed out of the earth and sandbags to protect Dakota Dunes and South Sioux City. Sioux City workers stacked sandbags to protect city water wells and other infrastructure along the riverfront. In industries in the Port Neal complex south of Sioux City put up berms and other flood protection barriers. Private businesses and homeowners took what measures they could to protect their property. Jim Walker cut short a family vacation at Disney World to return home to Windstone, a private residential development west of Dakota Dunes. Because the community is a private development, there was no local government to provide flood protection measures. Residents sandbagged their homes and pooled their own resources along with donated services to build levees along the river and to the east and west of the development. Despite our lack of experience with such a catastrophic event, we kept the water out of Windstone, said Walker, now president of the Windstone Homeowners Association. Windstone residents used their new experience to take steps to protect themselves from future flooding, Walker said. Homeowners along the river have incorporated berms into their backyard landscaping to keep the Missouri out. It was a big aid in March 2019 when the river surged quickly after a bomb cyclone dumped heavy rains across the region, filling creeks and rivers with torrents of rain, melting snow and ice. Though the berms kept the river out of Windstone, residents realized they needed a more comprehensive plan. They hired an engineering firm that's utilizing information the residents compiled in 2011, river data and maps, to develop a master flood response plan that should be finished later this year. We want to be proactive when the next flood event comes and not run around like chickens with our heads cut off when responding, Walker said. Proactive steps have been taken across the area since 2011. Brown said many of those levees industries erected in Port Neal remain in place. Communities have raised water wellheads so they wouldn't be endangered during flooding. They upgraded pumping equipment, increased their stockpiles of sandbags to protect critical infrastructure, and sent employees to flood-fighting training classes. In Sioux City, berms blending into the landscape remain in place to protect city infrastructure. A flood wall now protects the Chris Larson Park, Boat Ramp parking lot. Kelly Bach, Sioux City Parks Maintenance Field Supervisor, said plans are in place to protect infrastructure when the next flood comes. If we had a similar event to what happened in 2011, we'd know what's happened and what's going to happen. We look at where we've been and what we can do, Bach said. We continue to have those talks. Is there something we can do to mitigate those situations now rather than last minute when we have a flood? The high water event in 2019 exposed a weakness in Dakota Dunes flood protection, Dooley said, and another 500 feet of levee were added. The improvements in 2012 helped. After 2019, we saw some things we needed to improve, and we did, he said. It illustrated that no two floods are the same. The Missouri spilled into South Sioux City's Riverside Scenic Park in 2018 and again in 2019, causing thousands of dollars of damage to the park and other city infrastructure. Deanna Hagberg, Dakota County Emergency Manager, said the 2019 flooding also cut into the riverbank along the park, something that didn't happen in 2011 when South Sioux City's riverfront was underwater 4 weeks and buried under tons of sand after the river receded. One thing I learned in 2011 and 18 and 19, you never know what this river's going to do and how it's going to affect us, said Hagberg, who was deputy director to Pat Faust in 2011. Knowing that, Hagberg takes no chances and issues alerts whenever river levels begin to rise. It's one reason she believes the area is better prepared than it was 10 years ago. Back in 2011, it came on for some of us very quickly, she said. Now, when they start talking snowmelt and rainfall in certain areas, I'm all over it. If at any point the river starts rising, I start calling and asking questions. Since 2011, Dooley has educated himself on the increasing amount of river data the Corps of Engineers and National Weather Service provide. It enables him to better anticipate how much water will be flowing past the dunes and determine what, if any, flood protection action needs to be initiated. Today, that's part of my daily routine, checking the daily elevation, Dooley said. When the water is high in the river and reservoirs, I pay attention to see where it's raining. It's one of many new routines across the region. Officials pay more attention to river conditions, ready to implement the experience gained in 2011 and lesser flooding events since then. Emergency manuals are continually reviewed and updated. Emergency and government officials know another flood will occur someday, and when it does, they agree Siouxland is better prepared to stand up to it.
All right, thanks, Terry. We've had the eviction story. We've had the flooding story. Now for a couple news briefs off page two. A 38-year-old woman died early yesterday morning in a rollover on I-29 north of Elk Point. Around 3:42 yesterday morning, a 2002 Dodge Caravan headed south on Interstate 29, roughly 15 miles north of Elk Point. The vehicle entered the median, went back across both southbound lanes, entered the ditch on the west side, rolled, according to a press release from South Dakota Department of Public Safety. The 38-year-old driver hasn't been identified, wasn't wearing a seatbelt, was thrown from the vehicle, and she was pronounced dead at the scene. The area on I-29 was closed for about an hour. Traffic was rerouted. South Dakota Highway Patrol's investigating the crash. Another news brief from Ottawa. Hy-Vee distributed free cases of bottled water in Monona County yesterday. The community remains under a boil water advisory due to an issue with their water system. Monona County Sheriff advised residents in a social media post to pick up enough water to meet their family's needs until Monday. Hy-Vee provided more than 19 pallets of water. The grocery chain wrote in a press release, residents picked up 224 packs of bottled water per person. Ottawa issued the boil advisory on Friday when city tests of its water system noted that it would be a good precautionary measure. City water plant supervisor said a thunderstorm Thursday morning caused an electrical short, which led to the equipment failing at the water plant. The result in low water pressure allows bacteria to form in the water distribution system and trigger that boil advisory. Residents are advised to boil any tap water used for drinking, making ice, washing dishes, brushing teeth, or cooking. Water should be brought to a boil for 1 minute and then cooled.
Well, thank you, Hy-Vee, for that contribution to help those folks out.
From a page nine in the first section, news from the week in Iowa. Here's a baseball story. Newman Catholic junior baseball player Nash Hollingard did something that's never been done before in Iowa high school state baseball history. And he's never been done in a Major League Baseball history as well. He's hit the home run cycle, which is a player hitting a solo home run, a two-run home run, a three-run home run, and then a grand slam home run, all in the same game. Hollingard accomplished the feat in just six innings of play. He hit the grand slam in the first inning. He hit that solo shot in the second inning. He hit that two-run home run in the third inning. And then he had that three-run homer in the sixth. So he did all four of the home run cycle in six innings the other night.
Wow, he's got to feel great about that. Yes. Are there any other news briefs from this past week, Alan, that we should share? Let's take a look.
We've got Iowa's Department of Education announcing the commitment of $20 million of federal pandemic monies toward a new University of Iowa-based Center for School Mental Health that will, among other things, offer teaching, training, and needs assessment statewide for extra help with mentally incapable students, a growing population all the time. Let's see, other Iowa news. Danny Holman is planning to retire from the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. He's been president of the union for over 16 years. Governor Reynolds announced additional financial support for child care providers, including increased child care assistance rates, stipends to accelerate recovery from the pandemic, as well as enhancements to programs promoting educational opportunities for providers. Carbon sequestration story. The governor signed an executive order launching a task force to explore carbon sequestration and the opportunity she said it presents for further economic development across the state.
All right, we'll turn now to the opinion section in the Sioux City Journal. And the Journal's editorial board has this opinion to share. They write, "Have fun this 4th of July, but be mindful." Oh, they write, "Gratitude usually gets an outing in November. This year, we're seeing it in May, June, and July. Sensing the worst of the coronavirus pandemic is behind us, people are attending events in record numbers, and that's great. We saw it at the Tulip Festival in Orange City in May. We spotted it again last week when the Orpheum Theater was bulging for the Lee Brice concert. No doubt, we'll witness a surge this weekend at Saturday and Friday in the park. But if we've learned anything from a year of social distancing and staying close to home, it's this. People need people. You don't realize how much something means until you don't have it anymore." Which brings us to the point of the upcoming 4th of July holiday and its intended and its attendant parades, fireworks displays, concerts, and outdoor fun. Be careful. The last thing we need is an uptick in coronavirus cases or fires due to careless fireworks handling or boating accidents because of reckless driving. At the risk of sounding like a teenager's mother, we want you to have fun this year, but we want you to also be cautious around others and respect their space. Don't hover at parades. Don't crowd at concerts. Let everyone enjoy the moments on their own terms. We've heard of taunting because someone is or isn't wearing a mask, is or isn't vaccinated. Don't make others' decisions your tipping point. And when you're shooting off those bottle rockets, Roman candles, and fountains, be mindful of those around you. Someone may be frightened or stressed by the noise they make. After the year we've had, we're ready to celebrate. Just beware and grateful. That'll make this holiday weekend among the best of all. I'm going to turn next to the letter to the editor. We've got one that's been printed today, and this is from Brad Cummings of Orchard, Nebraska. So this is of particular interest to our Nebraska listeners. The title of his letter is "The Right to Repair Will Hurt Agriculture." He writes, "The past few years have been difficult for the agriculture industry, but we are now finally seeing new hope on the horizon as farmers are expecting a profitable harvest this season. Data released by the Department of Agriculture revealed farmers will earn $11.8 billion more from selling crops this year than in 2020. This positive trend is in part a result of increased exports to China at a high price. Our state lawmakers must focus on building on this movement, not passing fruitless legislation like Right to Repair that would hinder the agriculture industry's upcoming success. right to repair legislation would force agriculture equipment dealers and manufacturers to release their proprietary information and back-end code to the public. This move opens the door for bad actors to tamper with farm equipment, to potentially violate federal safety and emission standards. This legislation is also unnecessary, given that farmers have access to repair manuals, replacement parts, and diagnostic information to make a vast majority of repairs on their own equipment. There is a lot of misinformation being spread about the benefits of right to repair legislation, but in reality, it has significant safety and security implications that could derail the agriculture industry. Nebraska lawmakers should understand that this legislation may harm farmers' future harvest and should say no to right to repair.
It's about 30 minutes into the broadcast, and I'll turn to Steve Warnstedt, is in the column called The Regulars that appears every Sunday morning. And here's a frequently heard observation about present day. Too many jobs, too few workers. There's a reason why. Steve writes, meeting the workforce needs of employers is often viewed through a local lens. The challenges facing employers are significantly broader than often are discussed and will require a more comprehensive approach than usually discussed. State workforce leaders from the tri-state area recently met to highlight their challenges and how they are addressing them. Employers noted that each state presently has more jobs publicly posted than the number of unemployed residents. They also observed that unemployment rates are below what they were before the pandemic in some areas. A few common reasons were cited for the worker shortage. One, the most common, the federal supplemental unemployment compensation, discouraged people from working. While a factor, it was also recognized to be a relatively small factor. Recent data from Indeed.com shows that job search activity in Iowa and three other states ending unemployment compensation supplements early actually went down in the first week of June as compared to a month earlier. Hesitation on returning to the workplace was cited as a large reason. Some of the hesitation is due to personal health concerns that remain due to the pandemic. But more significant to the hesitation on returning to the workforce is the shortage of early childhood education and child care availabilities. It can be incredibly complex to find affordable, accessible, schedule-friendly services for children. Child care did get significant attention during the past Iowa legislative session. Getting less attention, though, was the fact that early childhood and child care providers also face a labor shortage. If we were really serious about the workforce and ensuring children make the most of their talents, there would be a whole of society effort on this sector of the economy. We'd encourage people to get into the field of child care and ensure that they had pay and benefits commensurate with their responsibility. Another factor that was mentioned was business culture. One of the tri-state workforce presenters highlighted the owner of a fast food restaurant in their state. That employer said that he did not have significant challenges in retaining employees. That may be due to rewarding his employees for meeting personal and business goals with items such as shoes or concert tickets that are valued by the individual employee. Now, in contrast, the New York Times published an analysis showing a personal turnover rate averaging 3% a week at some Amazon warehouses. The company frequently posts job schedules the day before, making family life pretty difficult. This is similar to what I have heard from some people employed locally. Employees were constantly tracked electronically, resulting in one being fired for having difficulty finding a job station within the warehouse without telling her where it was. A recent report called Pulse of the American Worker Survey indicated that roughly one out of four people would be seeking a different job once the pandemic ends. The two biggest reasons for that desire to change jobs was a better work-life balance and better compensation. Corporate culture and lessons learned from the pandemic have undoubtedly caused many Americans to think about what they want from their lives. A telling result is that 4 million people quit their jobs in April alone. There's a possibility that this problem will be with us for quite a while. The labor market analytics firm EMSI, said that the United States will need to address a long-term demographic drought brought on by three factors. First, the baby boomers are retiring at a significant rate. Second, the fertility rate is declining, with immigration failing to fill the gap. And finally, third, a labor participation rate that seems not to increase regardless of economic conditions. The challenge of meeting workforce needs ultimately needs to address the mismatch between available population and workforce size. That may require difficult, informed, and deliberate policy development. That may be an even larger challenge ahead.
And thank you, Mr. Warnstedt. And a reminder that Steve Warnstedt, a Sioux City resident, he is Government Affairs Coordinator for Western Iowa Tech and a former Democratic State Senator. So thank you very much. All right, it's now 36 minutes into our broadcast, and so it is time for us to turn to the obituaries today. Alan, would you start, please?
From Wayne, Nebraska, Nelda Ray Whiteman Kugler, 86 of Wayne, passed away Sunday, March the 8th at Wayne County Country View Care. A celebration of life will be 11 a.m. Thursday at Our Savior Lutheran Church in Wayne, Nebraska, with the Reverend William Caber and Jim Split and Debbie Valentine officiating. Interment will be a later date. Visitation 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at the church. Masks required at the service and visitation arrangements under direction of Haysman Funeral Home of Wayne. The service will be live streamed at the Savior Lutheran Church, Wayne, Nebraska, ELCA Facebook page. Next, from Sioux City, Mary Ann Hill. Let me back up a second here, back to the previous, the Nelda Kugler obituary. A last mention, memorials may be directed to Our Savior Lutheran Church. Nelda Ray Kugler, Friends of Music Scholarship, Wayne State College, or memorials may go to the Alzheimer's Foundation. Now moving to Sioux City, Mary Ann Hill, 81, died Wednesday, June 23rd. Abiding by wishes, cremations taken place and burial will be at a later date. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel assisting in the arrangements for Mary Ann Hill. Next, from Lamar's, LaDon Mott, Mr. Mott passed away Wednesday, June 23rd, surrounded by his loving family. Service is scheduled 2 p.m. Tuesday, June 29th, Rex Winkle Funeral Home of Lamar's. Reverend Christian Meyer from St. John's Lutheran Church in Lamar's will be officiating. Burial follows in Memorial Cemetery, Lamar's visitation with family 5 to 7 p.m. Monday at the funeral home. Visitation resumes 1 p.m. to service time Tuesday at the funeral home. Expressions of sympathy extended to the Rex Winkle, extended to family at the Rex Winkle website. And from Sioux City, Mary Burcham, or Burcham, B-U-R-C-H-A-M. Mary Burcham, 89, of Sioux City, passed away Saturday at her home. Per wishes, cremation has taken place in celebration of life. Will be held at a later date. Arrangements under the direction of Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. In lieu of flowers, family request donations directed to the Gospel Mission.
All right, I can turn next to the next obituary is for Russell E. Lane of Sioux City. He was 73 and he passed away Thursday, June 24th at his residence in Sioux City. Services will be held at a later date. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at the Christy Smith website. And then Marcia L. Stark of Sioux City, she was 56, and she passed away Tuesday, June 22nd at a local hospital. Memorial services will be 2 p.m. Friday, July 2nd, with a visitation 1 hour prior at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Interment will be at Logan Park Cemetery, and online condolences can be expressed through the Meyer Brothers Chapel website.
Next, from Sioux City, Eileen Silva, 75, passed away Thursday, June 24th at her residence. Massive burial at 10:30 Thursday at Holy Cross Parish Blessed Sacrament Church. Entombment at a later date. Visitation 5 to 7 Wednesday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Eileen was a member of St. Therese Study Group, and a rosary in her honor will be held 4 p.m. Wednesday at the funeral home. There will be a vigil at 7 p.m. that evening. Memorials may be directed to Queen of Peace or Boys and Girls Home. From Sioux City, Keith Allen Becker, 54, passed away Friday, June 18th at a local hospital. Memorial service is 7 p.m. Tuesday, June 29th. Visitation an hour prior to service. Nelson Berger Northside Chapel is handling arrangements. Online condolences may be left at the Meyer Brothers Chapel website. Next, from Sioux City, K. M. Keeper, first name C-H-A-E, middle name I-M, and last name is spelled K-E-I-P-E-R. K. Kuiper, perhaps, age 60, died Friday, June 25th. Memorial visitation July 1st, 5 to 7 p.m., Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. From Sioux City, Jack Arnold Miller, age 66, passed away unexpectedly June 25th. Service is 2 p.m. Tuesday, visitation noon to 2 at Moore Becker Hunt Funeral Home in South Sioux. Burial follows in St. Michael's Cemetery, South Sioux. Online condolences at the Meyer Brothers Chapel website.
All right, next we'll go to Diane E. Zimmer of Sioux City. She was 83, and she passed away Thursday, June 24th at her residence. Services will be at 11 a.m. Wednesday at Christy Smith Larkin Funeral Home in Sioux City. Burial will be in Memorial Park Cemetery following the service. Visitation will begin at 10 a.m. Wednesday at the funeral home. And Diane's family wishes to extend a special thank you to the healthcare professionals at Mercy One Hospital, June E. Nyland Cancer Center, and St. Croix Hospice for their loving care and compassion. Next is Dorothy D. Amick, A-M-I-C-K, of Sioux City. She was 96 and she died on Friday, June 25th. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff is making arrangements for her. And then we have Lillian Ray Wilson, formerly of Sioux City and of Odebolt. She passed away on December 13th, 2020, at Nevins Nursing Center in Methuen, Massachusetts. And there will be two celebrations of life for Lillian at 11 a.m. Friday, July 9th, at Arthur Evangelical Free Church in Arthur, Iowa, with a luncheon to follow, and 2 p.m., Saturday, July 10th at Meyer Brothers Funeral Home, the Morningside Chapel. it mentions that bright colors were always appreciated by and a reflection of Lillian. Therefore, the family encourages you to wear colorful and cheerful clothing when attending her services. And let's see. Memorials may be directed to the Sioux City Gospel Mission in Sioux City, Iowa. And then Harlan Dewey of Westfield, Iowa. He was 82 and he died Wednesday, June 23rd. The burial is private, Riverside Cemetery. Visitation will be June 28th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Akron, Iowa. And the last two obituaries today are Jerry R. Carrott, C-A-R-R-I-T-T of Onawa, Iowa. He was 85. And he died on Thursday, June 24th. The service will be June 29th at 10 a.m., Rush Family Chapel in Ottawa, and the burial will be Kennebec Cemetery in Castaigne, Iowa, with military rites. Visitation will be June 28th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the funeral home. Gerald Brayfogel of Sioux City, he was 84 and he died Thursday, June 24th. The service will be July 2nd, 10 a.m., St. Joseph Catholic Church, and the burial at Calvary Cemetery. The visitation, July 1st, 4 to 7 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel.
I'm going to stay in this business section of the page where we found the obituaries for an update on the Old Home Bread building and the renovation taking place there along Highway 75. This is a story by Mason Doctor. The former Metz Baking Company plant along Highway 75, distinctive and massive mid-century brick building, has been rehabbed by a Sioux City developer. Koskovich and Murphy Developments acquired the property at 1500 Highway 75 North in October for just under $800,000 from the former owner, Bimbo Bakeries. The property consists of about 4 acres with around 85,000 square feet of floor space between main building and smaller supporting building. The main building of tan and brown bricks was built 1947 at a cost of about $500,000 to house the Metz Bakery, which had long marketed its product under the Old Home Bread name. Construction on the bakery took place during a major post-war building boom in Sioux City. The amount of money being poured into developments that year had no parallel since the stock market crashed in 1929. The Metz Bakery was among the area's most expensive projects in 1947, amid material and labor shortages following the war. It was described as the million-dollar plant in the journal 1948. The plant was designed to embody the newest techniques in bakery design and structure, according to the description of the construction that ran in the journal in September 1947. A journal article the following year referred to it as America's most modern bread baking plant. At the time, 200 people were employed at the bakery. Its gas-fired automatic ovens could pump out 24,000 buns an hour. Every hour, its bread slicing and wrapping machines could get as many as 8,640 loaves sliced and ready for market. The facility changed hands repeatedly during the last 3 decades and was at various points owned by a whole succession of the country's largest baked goods conglomerate. 7 years have passed since the last batch of fresh baked bread left that plant. Ben Murphy, partner at Koskovich and Murphy, said the 74-year-old building was badly in need of some tender love and care when he and a business partner, Paul Koskovich, acquired the building. They stripped out everything from the stained ceilings to the miles and miles of pipes to the red clay floor flooring, keeping only the bare structure. Most of the bakery equipment was already gone. The bones were really good with that building. It just kind of was just let go, Murphy said. So we went in there, obviously demo, ed, pretty much everything. Everything from the roof to redoing the brickwork to tuck pointing to painting, new parking lots, landscaping, completely doing a new facelift on the whole facade and the interior. The exterior was painted gray. The original Art Deco Old Home Bread signs were removed from the outside. The vintage metal letters, which at one time were lit with neon, and they're planning on using them on the inside as a decorative element. Now, the interior was subdivided into smaller spaces, which Koskovich and Murphy are planning to rent out, mostly to commercial and light industry type firms. There should be room for 6 or 8 of them, Murphy says. The inside has the mid-century industrial feel with exposed beams and columns. We have several different tenants and we'll be going in there in coming weeks and months that we have deals with. Metz Baking, once the major employer in Sioux City Metro dating back to 1922, founding of the Metz Bakery, merged with Hallaman Baking of La Crosse, Wisconsin in 1988, doubling the company's size. And then in 1993, Specialty Foods acquired Metz and seven other food companies for a total of about $1 billion. Earth Grains acquired Metz in 2000. A year later, Earth Grains was acquired by Sara Lee. And then finally by Mexico City-based Grupo Bimbo, acquiring Sara Lee's bread-making business in a billion-dollar deal in 2010. Bimbo closed the Sioux City Bakery in 2014, taking with it 64 jobs. Bimbo Bakery's USA official at the time said that once cutting-edge bakery had become antiquated. That decision was made after an extensive assessment that concluded the aging facility could not compete in the marketplace and is not conducive to Bimbo's overall strategy for growth. Didre Molares, Regional Vice President of Operations for Bimbo, USA's Central Region, said in 2014 after the closure was announced. The old home building was used as a sort of a bread warehouse and a hub for semi-trucks thereafter. 5 years later, Bimbo closed its South Sioux City Bakery, the very last vestige of the Metz bakery that remained in the Sioux City metro area.
Go ahead.
A story from the Living section this morning by Dolly Butts, entitled Virtual Support. Some of the seniors Siouxland Pace serves have spent several months isolated in their homes amid the COVID pandemic. Candy Curry, clinical manager for the program that serves people 55 and older who live in Woodbury, Plymouth, Cherokee, and Monona counties, say the situation has been both physically and mentally challenging. An effort to keep these seniors better connected, PACE, which is operated by Unity Point Health in St. Luke's, purchased 75 grand pads. These are computer pads. The HIPAA compliant devices, which are specifically designed for seniors, allow PACE staff to set up telehealth appointments, other medication reminders, and perform physical and occupational therapy, and more, all without having to set a foot inside a participant's house. It's been a long year with COVID, Curry says. Not everyone in the population has a smart device or a computer or a smartphone. Sometimes they're limited on minutes on their phone, so we needed a way to connect with them through voice, and also we needed face-to-face contact with them. PACE seeks to keep older adults as active and healthy as possible in their own homes. Individuals eligible for Medicaid and Medicare or Medicaid only pay no premium for the service. Participants can sign up for a grand pad at no extra cost. Before, PACE member Dorothy Sprinkle recently secured a grand pad through the program. She said she never really used the technology. The 74-year-old said she wasn't intimidated by the device, however. I could play solitaire and bingo. It's easy to use it. I really like it, Ms. Sprinkle said. In fact, she was so pleased with the device that she told one of her friends about it. She said that friend now has a grand pad as well. Emily Hinna, PACE's community relations coordinator, says the program keeps two grand pads in its daycare center to allow participants to familiarize themselves with the device. If they decide they want their own, Hinna says they can sign up for one. If they feel comfortable using the ones here, then we can see if we can get one for their home, she says. Curry said even those over the age of 90 can learn to use a grand pad in just a matter of minutes. Grand pads aren't cluttered with apps like so many smartphones are. Only the essential apps and services are included. Large, brightly colored buttons make the device very easy to navigate, according to Curry. If they need to call PACE, all they have to do is push the big button that has a picture of PACE on it there. It's very user-friendly for them. They can also add their own friends or relatives on this grand pad. With the big buttons, they have a picture on there or just their name. If users run into trouble using the device, Curry says, All they have to do is tap a button and talk with a GrandPad staff member. She said the staff member receives the call, will even add family members and friends to their contact list for him. During the pandemic, Curry said being able to see participants hunkered down in their homes for a long-term care facility through video calls was just real crucial. She said PACE staff members were able to recognize skin issues early on and get participants the treatment they needed for that. The nursing facilities that we have contact with, we aren't always able to get in there because they have strict regulations, but they have to follow those. We were able to have face-to-face visits through this GrandPad, she says.
All right. Thank you, Alan. And if any of our listeners are interested in learning more about the GrandPads, what should they do?
They should contact PACE, that's P-A-C-E, and PACE may be found through the Unity Point Health St. Luke's phone numbers or website. And just look for PACE, P-A-C-E, for more about the GrandPad and learning about this great tool.
All right. And so as we approach the end of our broadcast, Alan and I would like to wish our listeners a happy week ahead, a safe Independence Day holiday, and we'll be back to share the journal with you in a couple weeks. Thanks for listening.
Happy 4th of July, folks. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.